Yes, I was a musician, I was a singer. But I then also very quickly realised I probably wasn't talented enough to have that career either. And I remember being brazen and going, sorry, could you just tell me what PR is? And I also think as a woman, you feel that you have to outwork to prove yourself. Have the confidence to know that if I don't know it now, I will tomorrow. And you don't have to tell me twice. Fear is something that holds people back. But the outdoor industry is built on fearlessness. When they go low, you go high. Feelings are what moves people. Feelings move the world. Just make it fun, make it cool. Because if you don't make it fun, why are we here? Our shared mission in life is to...
In this episode of Sports and Outdoor Mentors, I chat with Amanda Calder-McLaren, the CMO of Monterex, a cutting-edge active outdoor brand. We talk about Amanda's early career and her ability to ask the questions no one else would, her time at the North Face during their phase of phenomenal growth, and the reason she gives up her time to chair the nonprofit Opening Up the Outdoors, plus much, much more. Before we begin the episode, I have one request. Less than 50% of people watching or listening now are subscribed. So please hit the subscribe or follow button so we can inspire and provide valuable insights to even more people. Thanks for your support and enjoy the episode. Amanda, so growing up in London, studying science and maths in Manchester, and then music after that, postgrad in music, and then your first role, I believe, was as an analyst at KPMG. That's not like an obvious path to a career within the sports and the outdoor industry. So looking back, what are the key moments of your life that actually brought you to this point, you know, a senior role within the sports and outdoor industry?
Yes, definitely not linear. And I don't even know how helpful it is to share, because if people can take learnings from it. But yes, I studied maths. I studied maths and applied economics at UMIST in Manchester. And that was my first sort of leaving London and going up there to a lovely, Manchester's very warm, lovely people. And I had a great time. But then, yes, my career path from there, most people went to university with, it was at UMIST, it doesn't exist anymore. It got merged with Manchester. But most people from there ended up at Deloitte, Ernst & Young, KPMG. It was very kind of a bit of a, that was the path you meant to do. And I think it's probably the path my father wanted me to do. But I did find myself being constantly pulled more to the creative side, to the arts. And yes, I was a musician. I was a singer. I grew up singing in a gospel choir with loads of hip hop like acts. And it was kind of more of the DNA from where I'm from in North London. So I quickly went back and realised that I actually wanted to explore that side of me. So I did do a master's in music for a year, best year of my life. But I then also very quickly realised I probably wasn't talented enough to have that career either. But I was lucky because while I was doing my master's, my sister, Vicky Ellison, who also works in marketing in the fitness industry, got me a job at a place called The Third Space, which is like a renowned health club in London. And it was at the time owned by Joel Cabri and Ollie Weigels as Belongshop PLC. And so I started working there as a receptionist, but they very quickly realised that I had maths and all these other things, and I kind of became a bit more senior there in terms of some of the roles they wanted me to do. But then I kept saying to them, I don't really want to do accounts and I don't want to do this side of my life. I want to try something more creative. So they actually suggested PR. And I think I was like a 24-year-old, 5-year-old. I was still doing music. I was still kind of finding my feet, doing a bit of account work and consultancy there because obviously it paid better. And I said, do PR. So I was like, okay. And I'll never forget doing this. This was back in the days when magazines had phone numbers in the front of the magazines. That's how old I am. And so I was like, oh, I'll just call somebody. And I remember calling the editor of Men's Health, and I called the editor of Zest magazine. It was called Zest back then. It then became Women's Health, I think. And I remember being brazen and going, sorry, could you just tell me what PR is? And I remember thinking, oh God, looking back now, I never would have done that again. But they very kindly indulged me and turned up at The Third Space, at which point they sat down and I was like, okay, so what's PR and how does this work then? And they were a bit like, people don't usually ask that, but they wanted memberships. And therein lay became a beautiful relationship with loads of sports and fitness journalists who wanted access to The Third Space because it was an incredible health club. It still is, I believe. And it's grown and grown and grown. And so I sort of started becoming, creating this network of health and fitness and sports journalists off the back of that, Adidas kind of heard a bit about me, and a consultancy called Katie BPR, who were consulting for Adidas, called me up. And it was a woman called Kate Bosomworth who said, "We've heard about you. Apparently, all the journalists keep talking about you." And I was like, "I have no idea why," because I obviously had no formal training in PR and marketing at all. But she gave me my first foot in the door and hired me. And I remember one of the lessons was, which is a lesson I think is worth sharing, she wanted me to come in as like a manager, or I can't remember at the time, a PR manager, a comms manager. And I remember going, "I don't know how to do it. I'm not trained in that. I can do your accounts for you, but I probably can't do that." And so I remember asking her to bring me in at a lower level so that I could learn the books. And she was like, "It's weird. No one's ever asked that before, but sure." And then she taught me everything I knew. And within a couple of months, I mean, I ended up being there, I think, for nearly 7 years. And I ended up becoming almost her right-hand woman. I became director of the company and ran the sports and fitness portfolio, where I was lucky enough to work on Adidas for 5 years and launch Adidas Terex. I was lucky enough to work on Technogym, LucasAid, Maxi Muscle at the time was epic. The guy, the team there were amazing. Loads of different Monster headphones, Beats headphones. So I kept my connections with music. And I had a great 20s and 30s, basically, kind of running around doing so many different, from FMCG to apparel to sportswear, and learning all about how to do it, which was great. Got seconded into clients for little periods of time. Like, spent a lot of time in the Addy office and learned from there. And then someone heard about me, North Face, called me up and asked me to come and work for North Face. I said no, because I'd met my husband. Okay. So I was like, "I'm going to take a chance on this one." I said no, but then I ended up being able to consult for them from London for 2 years. And then it was the right decision because the boyfriend became the husband. So clearly I didn't bet on the wrong thing. And then we all moved over to the North Face. And that was 7.5 years ago. Yeah. And now I'm here. I've left the North Face and I'm at Monterex, which is the next evolution in my career, in my opinion.
Okay, great. So let's spend just a little bit of time around North Face. And as you said, so you'd spent, I think, let's say your first 13 years of your career in the UK. And then you took what was a big decision, especially actually, you know, your boyfriend had become your husband, and you relocated to Switzerland. And then you worked in Switzerland for what, 6 years?
It's nearly seven, yeah.
7 years. Yeah, yeah. So looking back, what are the good and the bad experiences of working in another country?
I think when you're thinking about where to work, what matters most isn't the country, it's the company. So I always wanted to go into the North Face and go and work abroad. I was always kind of open to moving around and adventures all over the shop. But it was the pull of the brand that got me to move in the end. Like I did have a husband, I had a baby at this time, and I was like, oh gosh, like relocating is a big thing. But actually it's not. You're like an hour away on a flight, and like the world opens up when you are willing to go and explore it. And like, that's just, I guess, a bit my mentality. Like, you know, you don't know till you try, and you have to explore these things. So moved out there for North Face, best decision ever made. I had a fantastic 7 years in the North Face, part of VF, and I loved it. And my husband was very supportive about going out. But I'd say the things you need to be mindful of if you're considering moving is it somewhere that you see yourself being there for a while? Because moving for shorter periods is, I think, a bit more labor intensive if you have a family. If before you potentially have a family, the world's your oyster because you can chop and change as you need. But I'd say don't move flippantly. Explore the country, explore the people, explore the culture, see if it's going to work for you. Because the worst thing is if you've upped and moved and then you find yourself unhappy and you're quite, and you know, if you're far away from your network or your community, that's hard. Whereas I was quite lucky, my community was pan-Europe anyway. So I knew loads of people, and the outdoor community, I think, is a special one because people embrace you and you know people who are close in the mountains or whatever, and they kind of immediately kind of bring you in a bit, which is helpful. So if you know people, it's a small world, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Small world and an even smaller industry.
Yeah, exactly. It has its pluses and its minuses.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm sure the audience would be really interested to hear from somebody that worked for, you know, a reasonably long time at a, you know, a very large public company and progressed within that. I think when you joined, you were communications director for EMEA and then you moved into a global role, I believe.
Yeah, I was actually senior manager to start with. So I came in as senior comms manager, then I became a director, then I became director of marketing, senior director that way. So yeah.
What's the secret to, you know, progressing and you know, I don't know, maybe it's my word, but you let me know whether it's right, kind of thriving within that environment and really developing yourself and your career?
I don't know if I have the answer, because everyone gets their different ways, but I would say the things that I have found help me or my secret success is a few things. Work ethic. So I do believe in working really, really hard. And I also think as a woman, if I can say it like this, you feel that you have to outwork to prove yourself. And I don't feel like that anymore, but I definitely felt like that in my 20s and 30s where I just felt like I had to be ahead. I felt like I had to work harder. I felt like I had more to prove. I also felt like people would underestimate if I had the skill set or right. Like, I think one of the number one things I've had my whole career is, oh, you have a master's degree. Yeah. Why? Like, it's a, people can often judge you, especially as a woman, a young woman in the outdoor industry, or, and I'm not a shy person. I'm quite there. I'm quite present. I'm quite loud. I'm quite energetic. I am quite, for want of a better word, a bit like more culturally astute. And that can be a bit intimidating, especially to people when they're not used to that level of energy. So I found I had to like make sure I really backed everything up all the time and had it locked down, if that makes sense. So I do think working really hard. The second thing I think is just to be open-minded. If I don't know something, that's okay. I'm going to ask and I will be able to figure it out. And I need people to help me. So I don't like it when you sit there and people go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And you're like, yeah, but is it really, yeah? Do you know what I've said? Like, don't be afraid to go, so I don't know what that means. You're like, I don't know that acronym. People are awful at using acronyms in big companies, especially in marketing. If you don't know what it means, that's okay. Just ask. Have the confidence to know that if I don't know it now, I will tomorrow. And you don't have to tell me twice. Help me to learn. And I think there's a lack of that learning culture in big companies that you need to pretend to know so that you can move forward. Whereas I don't think that's the answer. The answer is to not know, to ask questions. And instead of kind of having the answers, it's better to have better questions. And that's how I've been lucky enough to learn and move forward. But also I find if you ask questions, people give you the answers and people are willing to sit with you. No one says, no, I'm not going to teach you that. So, you know, the size of the business I knew nothing about, like supply chain or ops or, you know, even product development. I knew nothing about product development when I first went in, but I had amazing people who showed me and taught me stuff so that you get a more rounded view. And I think that is a real secret of success.
Interesting. I wanted to pick up on something you said. You said that as a woman, particularly at the start of your career, you felt like you had to prove yourself more somehow. But later on, now you don't. What's changed? Is it that I'm a little scared to ask this question, but is it that the industry's changed or is it just that you're like, you just don't care if I put it bluntly?
No, I don't believe the industry has changed. I have changed. And I just think it's age, it's wisdom, it's, I have a lack of time, I'm a full-time working mum of two. So now I'm a bit like, you know what, I know what I can do, I know what I can't do. And I know you kind of get a bit of a confidence or a bit more of a sense of self. And also there's a really famous quote, I'm not going to say it because it's a whole, I can't quite remember the entire quote, but one of the most leading women in business said, after I'd sat in enough of these rooms, with enough of these people, I realized I could also sit in these rooms. So like at first, when you were first made a member of a management team, I remember being like terrified and sitting around the table going, oh, everyone's very clever. They're going to say really important things. I'm not going to know the answers. And I had to remind myself, I don't know the answers, but I will know the questions. And then by the end of it, you've asked so many questions that there's no more answers left in that room. And then you move to the next room. And it's like, do you know what? If you are the cleverest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And like, I sometimes think management teams, rooms don't remember that. They like to be the cleverest person in the room or they like to have the loudest voices in the room. And I think that's where we're going wrong in our industry.
it's interesting because it goes back to what you just said actually about at the start, you know, when you're asking about PR. So that's obviously a recurring theme.
Yeah, I like to ask questions.
Yeah, but it's funny because I tell the same thing to my son. I'm like, it's the people that are in the room and raise their hand and ask questions, they're the smartest people in the room.
Yeah, probably. You
know, it's
well, they'll become the smartest person.
All the time.
Yeah, alert. It's like a bit like a what they call it in management meetings, a growth mindset.
Yes,
but exactly. It's just, it's not even that. It's just wanting to know, wanting to learn, wanting to grow as a person, I think is really important. And there's so many smart people out there, more experienced people, that you'll always learn something from somebody, and especially the other way around. Like, I've also found that brands stop growing when they stop asking young people what's happening. Like, the best brands employ really young people who come in with a different perspective, and they know more about like social media and what's cool, what's not, than I ever will again. So like, you've got to keep those people, your network around you has got to be challenging you and giving you information and moving you forward.
How do you navigate and promote positive change in an industry that is very, and I need to be a little bit careful about this being fitting within this group, but very white male driven? I think, and also not just from a leadership point of view, but also from a practice point of view as well.
It's a boring rhetoric, but I do think it needs to be said that the workplaces and the current infrastructures, not just in our industry, in many of them, they haven't been designed to cater for females in the room. But that's also okay, because change happens gradually. We're like, I feel a bit like my generation are the kind of the first line of women, I guess, on the front line, where we are in the room. There are quotas now. We are getting to a point where the workforce is 50-50. Most of my peers, the women work. You know, I don't have many where they don't anymore. And that's a nice change because it's balancing, but also it is a new change. So it is a generational shift, a generational change. And I do think that at times it can feel tense. There's tensions where people want it to go in a certain way, and it's hard. The dynamics can be hard. And there's also a feeling of tokenism in the room. There's a feeling of modulating your behaviours to fit into all male environments. Now, none of those things are wrong. They're called coping mechanisms. And that's what we have to do and how we have to play at times. But I also think that there are different approaches you can have. So if the room is also willing to change, then you can change together. But when there's a kind of you feel like you're pushing uphill, or they call it the glass ceiling, if there's no one on the top who's also trying to shatter it, that's when it's hard. Whereas when you have allyship, is I think the most powerful word that we don't use enough. And if you have real models of allies in companies who are willing to say stuff. I remember being in a couple of rooms where afterwards I had to go and speak to the senior men around the table. I said, why did none of you say anything when I was making that point? And they were like, well, we just didn't think it's our place. And I was like, yeah, but it was. Like, I just needed one person in that room to back me. And it wasn't a commercial issue. It was more like a social issue to do with optics on a stream of work that was designed to be win with women for some reason. And they'd put men on as leading it. And I was like, can we look at that? We don't need to get to that level of detail. But I found it interesting that when I was in that room, I felt lonely and I felt very like, oh God, why is no one backing me here? Like, I know. And then after, they all agreed with me on a one-on-one basis. And actually, I wasn't cross. I was like, just please next time say something. Even if you're not sure, you can say something. And I do find more people are starting to model allyship and show you a bit more of support, even if it's just the way something's framed or phrased. If you find a female colleague isn't getting her point across properly because of the way the room and the dynamic is, maybe rephrase and support. It's not about talking over or like undermining a woman's power. It's actually just helping. It's like equity modeling. Help somebody to get into the room and make the point and get something across the line if you see it's not working, but yet you agree with the person. So those are the kind of behaviours that I think will help. And also I just think an understanding or an acknowledgement that the environments are more tailored to male dynamics, which is normal as well. Like peer groups, people, unconscious bias, familiarity, comfort levels, they're all there and they're all normal. women like hanging out with women, men like hanging out with men, that's okay. But if you can find an environment where different communication styles can exist, different people who ask questions, people can be heard, then that comes down to the leader in the room. And if we can have more dynamic, understanding leaders, you will find that the room will thrive together. And the only other point I think that's worth making on this, and this comes back to a little bit of the work I do on Aoto, which is for some reason, we have come to a place where people don't think that you can pull another seat up to the table. It's almost like a one in, one out mentality where people are scared, or the existing patriarchy, for want of a better word, feel slightly under attack somehow. Like, I once have an anecdote where I was out with a very senior vice president, let their guard down, and used the phrase, black people and women are coming for my jobs. And I was quite impressed with him for saying it to me, of all people. But at the same point, I was furious. I was so cross. I got so cross. I think I even cried. I was so cross that that's how he really felt, and that he'd let me into a window of his world. And then I reflected on it for a while and I realized it's not his fault. It's really not his fault. I hear people say we've gone too far with positive quotas and stuff like that. And the truth is, as frustrating as it was to hear, he has been taught that there's only four seats at the table. And that he, who's worked just as hard as those women and other people to get his qualifications, to get to where he is, he feels that he won't now have as fair a chance because other people need to get in the room. So therefore, he'll lose a seat. Now, it's the scariest place, because what you've actually ended up doing is pitting men against women and black people against white people. It's just not like that. You don't need to be like that. You can pull more seats around the table. And we can all have a place. And yes, it does mean a bit of a power shift overall, but like that level of thinking is where the outdoor industry becomes very secular and it closes its doors because it's scared, it's insecure. But there doesn't need to be like that. If you have more of a growth mindset, or if you're willing to open and be an ally, then everyone gets to play together. It's not an either or scenario. So I think that's the biggest shame that needs changing, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, yeah. And then connected directly to that, you're the chairperson of Opening Up the Outdoors, so which is a non-profit that was founded back in 2021.
So Aoto is, it stands for Opening Up the Outdoors, and it's part of the It's Great Out There Coalition. We're a subsection, and Aoto exists to promote joy, excellence and belonging for people of colour in the outdoors. It was founded it was before the Black Lives Matters movement, but that definitely gave a little bit of an impetus to really get things going. And it was five brands came together: North Face, Patagonia, Adidas, Arc'teryx and Vivo Barefoot. We were the founders, but it since has a lot more members. So Salomon and Osprey and Wiggle and I'm hoping to add more and more and more. So if anyone's listening to this and they'd like to get involved, that would be delightful. And we've got an incredible board. I'm the proud chair for the last couple of years, but loads of people worked on getting it together. And it exists to acknowledge that there are barriers. So that's the first problem we have. People just think the outdoors is for free, run up a mountain. Same as it used to be for football, kick a ball. We're well aware that's not the case, because there's mounds of evidence and research that shows it's not like that. People aren't felt welcome. And I can even give tangible examples of this, because when I moved to Switzerland, one of my biggest considerations moving from like North London, which is super, I grew up in a super multicultural upbringing, all colours, all creeds, all races, all genders, melting pot, came to the mountains, and without oversharing, my husband's black and my children are brown. So, I've never been apathetic to issues of race, but I didn't realize how pronounced it would feel when we moved to Switzerland. And often where it feels most pronounced is in the mountains, where I have countless examples of ski instructors quizzing my son as to where he's really from, which, fair enough, I get it. They're trying to be kind. They're trying to, in a naive way, they're trying to be inquisitive. What they're actually asking is where my husband's parents are from. They didn't ask mine though. So what you've done by trying to show interest is you've made someone feel different and unwelcomed, or like they weren't, for want of a better word, fitting in. And when you do that to children, or when you do that to anyone, you should always take the first answer. So when my son says he's from London or from Lugano, that's where he's from. Don't quiz him about his genetics, because you didn't to the other two Italian kids or the Swiss kids or the white kids. Yeah. So those little examples, and I've got examples where my daughter had snow in her hair and everyone laughed and they did that to her hair. Don't touch a black woman's hair, for a start, or don't touch a white woman's hair, but don't touch hair, like, unless you're invited. It's just modes of behaviours that is coming from innocence. At the same point, it's offensive. So you just have to be aware of all these things. And there are a lack of instructors and pathways for people of colour in the outdoors. And it's something I came up against a lot at the brand. There was a time when I took over sports marketing for North Face about 4 years ago. And I innocently asked where the black athletes were. We didn't have any in EMEA. And I can say that. But it was the response from some all the teams and the agency people of just like, well, there just aren't any. You can't force them. And I was like, there aren't any, or you don't know where they are. And within 3 years, funnily enough, we have some incredible black athletes on our roster. Dennis Rinalta, Molly Thompson-Smith, David Gite. They're there. They just might not have the linear pathways to get the exposure. And no, you can't find them because they have different networks. But they're there. And they're kind of coming up. And yeah, they might need a little bit more searching for, but they're there. And don't underestimate them. So, and learn how to work with them, learn how to find them. So yeah, those, that level of kind of just not understanding and not kind of getting it or realizing it's important, because you can't be what you can't see. And then there's also, I think one of the biggest things Auto can do is help brands have these conversations. I am lucky that I'm in a dual heritage relationship, because I get to ask the questions in my own house. And yes, we have Frisian conversations at times. I'm white, he's black. We're from two different cultures. But when we come together and we talk about, oh, okay, that's your perspective, that's my perspective. Like I said, ask questions. You learn a lot very quickly. And I realize not everyone has access to those levels of communities and cultures. But if you don't, find them and ask the questions and find out what will work. But even having a conversation about race can be uncomfortable for people, because they don't know what vernacular to use. Like, I've never met a black person who doesn't mind being called black, but I have met a lot of white people who are very nervous to call somebody black, because the vernacular has changed as we've grown up. When I was growing up, you'd call somebody mixed race. Now you wouldn't call them that. You'd call somebody half caste. Never use that now. You know, so things change and evolve, but people have to change and evolve and understand the language. But whatever you do, have the conversations. It's better to make mistakes and understand if you've said the wrong thing, so that you can truly move forward. So Auto helps with consultancy. We can help with education. We can help with benchmarking. We can help with pathways, community cultures. You know, if you're struggling to attract black talent or people of color into organizations, let's have a conversation about it, and we can help work out why. And there's some very clever people on the board of Auto, from creatives to diversity experts to ex-mega snowboarders, Phil Young and Keme Nezkarema, the two of the founders. And they're incredible humans. They should definitely be on this podcast if you haven't talked to them. And so, yeah, having the conversation and making sure that we're just pointing out things is important.
I was going to ask you, what would be your advice to help people address this, but I think you've just clearly articulated that, so that's perfect. That saves me a question.
Oh, good.
No, but I think to your point, it's a lot of it is that people don't know how to maybe address the topics, and because of that, a lot of times people are scared to do it, and then it just gets in a bit of a vicious circle.
Yeah, but then the world won't move forward, and I think fear is something that holds people back. But the outdoor industry is built on fearlessness. It's built on people taking on challenges that you didn't think were humanly possible. So why is it we can climb mountains, but that figuratively we can't climb this mountain? And I just think it's about being open-minded and trying and remembering you can pull up more seats to the table. No one is taking yours away. Like, that's what's important.
You've now started a new challenge, a new adventure.
Yes.
At now, how do I pronounce it?
Monterex.
Monterex. Okay, yeah. It is as it looks. So you've gone from one of the largest brands within the sports and outdoor sector to a challenger brand, a brand that's growing very quickly and establishing itself very quickly in the kind of sports adventure arena.
Yeah.
But it's quite a big contrast. So I know it's early days, but what are the guys kind of early lessons and things that you're kind of discovering, I guess, every day?
Yeah, for sure. I was really lucky at North Face. It was an utter privilege to work on that brand, and the team there are incredible. And I know I'll miss it a lot, but I also think it was definitely my time. I think as a marketeer, especially, 9 years on that brand, 2 years consulting, you need to change and keep things fresh, because also new energies and ideas need to come in. You know, you need to also clear the path a little bit to let freshness drive forward. And what I really love is mixing the things together. So North Face was always great for me because it was a bit of outdoor and technicity, an incredible product with culture, with style, with fashion and music. And that's my area of expertise, is bringing in the culture and the sport and the street style, as well as technicity and challenge and adventure. So those are the things I'm good at. And I'm also good at driving big brand growth, basically, like getting things to be famous, for want of a better word. And I'm a real gut marketeer. So I've been really lucky. I've learned lots of different schools of marketing across my career, from working in Lucozade and Maxi and FMCG-based products to working in more fashion and music. And there are different ways of marketing, which people don't tend to acknowledge. And I was lucky enough, I had some bosses who have also worked at FMCG. And I realized that my school of marketing is definitely more comfortable in the cultural gut sense of marketing. Okay. Like, I have very polarizing opinions on consumer insight panels for adverts and things like that, that I'm like, I would rather share it with 20 of the people I trust influentially across Europe who are at the cutting edge of sport and fashion than I would an insight panel run by a consumer insight testing research lab that's asking Joe Public. I'm very clear that whose opinions I feel are at the forefront of setting trends and opinions. But in bigger companies, they need that level of validation, trust, and security. So I think for me, it was time to go back and find a brand with fresh, young, challenging energy that we could bring in all of this creativity and really drive this to grow. So Monterex's story is super cool. Two young guys, Danny and Kieran, founded it from their home in Liverpool. And it is one of those rise to prominence stories that gives you goosebumps. They just really cared about making product that fits well, that was colorful, stylish, fashionable, sporty, and could take you outdoors. And that's what they did. And they made it in 5 years. They're now one of the fastest growing sportswear brands to come. But it's because they found that kind of sweet spot between color and fashion, technicity, affordability, and adventure. So they kind of did the three, whereas a lot of brands struggle to do two. Style and sport, or style and adventure, but to do sport, style and adventure, it's dreamy.
Sounds like an exciting challenge for you.
I hope so. It's a big challenge because I'm more experienced on more established brands, but I feel like it's taking those lessons that I've learned from big brand behaviors and networks and how stuff work, and then bringing it to more of a challenger brand. Hopefully I can add value.
I'm sure you will. You mentioned a few minutes ago that fact that you've had some great bosses throughout your career. But have you ever kind of actively looked for coaching or mentoring outside of your, let's say, professional environment?
I am a huge believer in mentorship. Huge, which is why I love your podcast. And I just want to say thanks for everything you're doing, because I do think it's fantastic. I've been really lucky that I've had incredible female bosses as well. And I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them. Kate Bosanworth gave me my first stand in life. She was ran her own agency, but she's CMO of M&C Saatchi, and she's incredible. Kath Smith, who I'm now back together with at Monterex, but she was one of the most inspiring women in sports and apparently she taught me a lot about business, and she also agreed to be my mentor, which is fantastic. I have had a lot of male influences as well, but it's been the women that have stuck with me because somehow they've understood the plight of a senior female in a different way and given me more coaching and things like that. But I definitely don't think mentorship needs to be restricted to your industry in any way. I had some incredible creatives who've helped give me advice, creative directors at fashion houses and at magazine publishing houses. I learned a lot from there. I just would say, seek out people who challenge you, but who know more than you, who you can ask questions of, and they give you the real answers. But I would also say that wherever a company you're in, mentors amongst your own peer group is really important. Like, I had some incredible female directors at VF across the brands who you could just look at across the room and you knew that they were understanding your challenges, and as well as having some great allies in the room. And I can name them too, but you do need to sort out your support system, not from a political, you know, networking perspective. You know how to find those people and they will help you up. It's more the people who will help you when you're having a really bad day and when you need advice as to how to navigate something that you've messed up or that you just feel like you're banging your head against a wall. You need someone who's going to go, come on, look at it a different way. Try again, get back up. Do you know what I mean? So I banged the table. Get back up because you're needed in that room and the people behind you need you to be in that room. And as I've got more senior as a woman, I felt that is a huge motivation for me. Looking around the room at they're not there yet. They're not a senior yet, but they want to get there and they need to see you, but they also need to see that it's not easy. So you have to share a level of vulnerability, but you also have to hold it down when you need to hold it down. Because, you know, sometimes you can't let the cracks show.
A nice, easy question for you. Or maybe, let's see. So what's your favourite piece of sports or outdoor gear? And you're not allowed to say something from any brand that you've worked for.
Oh.
That's way too easy. Way too easy.
This gilet. No.
Exactly.
God, my favourite piece of kit. It is something I have worked for, though. Am I allowed to say that? So there's two. One is one of the first shoes I ever worked on, which was 510 rubber. And when that came out, I just thought that was epic because of the grip and the functionality it gave. And it just shook the industry a bit when, like, they did align with Adi. I loved working on that. That footwear was legit. And the other one I absolutely love is the duffel bag. Am I allowed to say it? North Face duffel bag. It's just one of the best things in the world. Take it anywhere, do anything with it. I just think it was super, super clever and really well designed, and I will always use them.
Yeah, a good example of keeping something simple, you know. It's
There's a need. You know, there's a clear consumer need. It's functional, it's practical, but it's also fashionable. Just get the job done, you know. I think that's key.
So is there a book that you would advise anybody to read that is working in the industry or would like to work in the industry and kind of develop as a leader?
Oh, so I've read so many books on all of this topic because I felt like in my 30s I had to read every nonfiction book in the world, you know, Thinking Fast and Slow, Dysfunctional Leadership Teams, blah, 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 like From Good to Great. I read them all, to be honest, because I like to ask questions. But I'm going to be super honest, and it was a book that really helped me get my head around work internationally. It was The Culture Map by Erin Meyer. And I really struggled as a British woman transitioning to different cultures, how and when you should speak in rooms. And I am very outspoken, so I have to learn that. And that book really helped me understand that people weren't ready to necessarily listen to me in the way I just thought they'd just take it. And I had to kind of navigate different cultural expectations on me. So not the stereotypical how different, you know, countries behave. And, you know, you can have those horrible stereotypes, how British people are, how French people are, how German people are. More the how to communicate in a way that people are open to hearing it and you don't come across as a threat or you don't come across as, you know, with any intention I didn't want to come across with. And I think everyone needs to check themselves. I don't mean it's a man-woman thing. I think that, like, yeah, sometimes how it sounds in your head and when you say it is not is not right, it's not working. And that book helped me kind of navigate that. So I'd say that book is really good. If you're willing to, if you want to work in more European or pan-global situations, I found that a very helpful book. But then the other book I would really recommend is, oh, I can't remember the name of it. Wait, okay, that'll come to me. But it's to do with being your authentic self in any situation. Okay. And I think it's hard to be you when people say, and I've been called everything, bossy, too much, tone it down. I've had it my whole life. They're probably not wrong. But the best people have seen past that and realized that that's a skill. That's what gets me in the room. That's what gets my brands to grow. If your ego can't take it, is that really my problem? But so the combination of the two, like knowing how to land a message so that you, someone's listening to you, but not being you or being made to feel that you shouldn't be you in the room, that's not a nice feeling.
Well, if you don't remember it, we'll follow up and I'll put it up in the post, the show notes. What's the most valuable piece of advice you've ever received?
When they go low, you go high.
Okay.
It's my mantra. So, and I found it works in every situation because as soon as you hit react to something or you're cross, I'm a bit like a female lioness as well. If you come at my team or if you come at even my brand, like I get fiery and I'm like, wait, stop. They're going to behave like that. When they go low, we go high. Like, and it helps me to model better intentions. So don't send that email. Stop. It's low bar behavior, low brow. They're trying to, throw you under a bus. Don't throw them back. Just share the actual facts. Like, take the higher ground. That's my main piece of advice. If you can remember it, it's really important. And the only other, the second piece of advice, and I think it's more specific to maybe my area, is it's an old phrase, but it's people will forget what you said, but they'll remember how you made them feel. I couldn't agree with it more. And I think it applies to brands. You have a feeling. Brands give you a feeling. You can't tell me why. You can't tell me which exact campaign it was that made you feel that, or what somebody said, or it's not that. Feelings are what moves people. Feelings move the world. So if you can find a way to add feeling, add intention to something, then that's what that person will take away. And it's the same when you're delivering bad news. They really won't remember the words. They're just too upset. You know, it's like your brain can't function in all these levels. So as long as you load everything up with intention, so whether it's how you're looking, how you're speaking, your body language, remember to give people the feeling you want. So if you're cross with somebody, you know, change your intentions, but they'll remember how you felt in that room. So if you don't make somebody feel something, then you either won't be memorable or they'll remember the wrong thing.
So if today was the last day of your career.
Oh, what am I? That's come quick.
Yeah, sorry, that's no.
Yeah, sorry, it's not been working out for you, Monterex.
What message would you give to the team here at Monterex?
Oh, have fun. Sorry, but simple, but just make it fun. Make it cool. Whatever that coolness looks like to you. Do you know what I mean? If it's rappers or snowboarding or whatever you want to do, go and like have fun. Because if you don't make it fun, why are we here?
Perfect. So last question. So the aim of this podcast and YouTube channel is to really help people on their journey, their career path in the sports and the outdoor industry. So with that in mind and considering everything we've already discussed, is there something that you would add or something that we've forgotten that you would just want to kind of leave people with?
Yes. And I think the outdoor industry is incredible. It's full of people who care so deeply. And we are an industry that has a level of responsibility as well to the environment and things like that, because we're at the closest touch point. But I would also say the outdoor industry, we're also our own worst enemy in how we try and isolate us away from everything else. And I know it's coming from a place of protection and humility. I get it. At the same time, I think we're just sometimes really close-minded and we don't move things forward for the benefit of expanding participation. Everyone says they want to, sell more jackets, right? But to sell more jackets, you have to invite more people in and you have to open the doors. And I mean, you mentioned before, I wrote a thing about the Moncler mishap on my LinkedIn, and I know everyone got very opinionated on it, but sometimes the outdoor industry can just be incredibly arrogant and incredibly cold to people. Like, you don't belong here. You're not a good enough skier. You don't know how to tie the knots properly. You don't know how to set your bindings properly, you know, like, and that energy, I just don't think is helpful, because the truth is, if you're really good, you'll shine anyway. You know, there's some incredible athletes and performances out there that don't need to be done in that way. I'm not really articulating myself well, but I feel that if we could only just realise that if we opened the outdoors up a bit, yeah, and invited other sectors in and made it a bit more of an inclusive place, everyone will win. But not only that, our shared mission in life is to protect the planet. And outdoor people feel that so deeply. And there's a fine line between too many people coming in, like, you know, messing up the outdoors, for want of what people say, and also making them really aware of the benefits, so that then they protect the outdoors in the urban, social, economic environments where it's being destroyed. So you can only win if you're willing to do that. And that would be something I would love our industry to start thinking about a bit deeper.
Great. Thank you very much, Amanda.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for this podcast.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you did, please leave a comment below. A new episode will go live in 2 weeks, so subscribe to be sure you don't miss it. Thanks again for your support, and see you soon.